Okay.
Okay. So welcome everyone to a public lecture from the Law School, the first actual public lecture that we're having this year after the previous one was cancelled, unfortunately. So I hope you didn't turn up to the last one, but this one is a great event for the school, and it's a great pleasure for me to welcome Professor Nicola Lacey from the London School of Economics to Warwick to deliver the public lecture today. Professor Lacey is an expert in criminal law, in legal theory, particularly feminist legal theory, and she's also an expert biographer. I'm just going to read out a list of her books, which reads actually a bit like a 19th century novel from the titles when you combine them all together. They include State Punishment, Reconstructing Criminal Law, The Politics of Community, Unspeakable Subjects, which collects her essays on feminist legal theory, a biography of H.L.A. Hart called A Life of H.L.A. Hart, The Nightmare and the Noble Dream. And this year, she's produced two books, which have come out, two series of lectures, The Prisoner's Dilemma, which derives from the Hamelin Lectures, which is on crime, punishment, and political economy, and Women, Crime, and Character, which is concerned with the understanding of women's criminality in the 18th and 19th century, drawing particularly on literary sources. Professor Lacey's interdisciplinary approach to criminal justice studies sits particularly well with criminal justice studies at Warwick, and I'm also happy to launch the Centre for Criminal Justice at Warwick, which is a research centre which will help to coordinate and further our activities in criminal justice at Warwick over the years to come. Warwick itself has a long tradition of criminal justice research, a very distinguished one, and one which has a multidisciplinary approach drawing from philosophy, sociology, and other related subjects. And we hope to continue that broad research agenda into the future, using the Criminal Justice Centre as a vehicle for it. So without further ado, let me hand over to Professor Lacey, who's going to be delivering her lecture, which is entitled Psychologizing Jekyll, Demonizing Hyde, The Strange Case of Criminal Responsibility. Without further ado, Professor Lacey.
Thank you. Can you all hear me? Is the microphone working? Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you so much, Victor, for that very generous introduction. It's lovely to be here. I've had a long friendship, both with Warwick University, with the law school in particular, and with many individuals in this audience, including Victor. So it's very nice to be here to, as it turns out, inaugurate your public lecture series this year. And I'd just like to wish the centre every success. It sounds like a wonderful initiative, building on so much wonderful scholarship in criminal justice, which has happened at Warwick really ever since the beginning of the law school. So, in early 1886, strange case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde burst onto the literary scene, selling 40,000 copies in the first 6 months after publication alone, entering the collective consciousness, and in doing both of those things, catapulting the 35-year-old Robert Louis Stevenson to fame. But what does this publishing sensation have to do with criminal law? Stevenson himself was trained as a lawyer. He was writing at the end of the second successive century in which English fiction had been hugely preoccupied with law and the legal profession. He devised a plot in which criminality occupies centre stage, and he presented much of that plot in the legally inspired form of testimonial evidence. Moreover, the book could be read as a metaphor for anxiety about one of the most persistent myths of criminal justice, the hope that criminality and innocence, right and wrong conduct, good and evil character, can readily be distinguished. Now, my purpose in this lecture is to put Jekyll and Hyde to work for a rather specific analytic purpose. The question of responsibility for crime, complicated by the divided subjectivity implicit in Mr. Hyde's appearance and illuminated by Stevenson's grasp of contemporary psychiatric, evolutionary, and medical thought as promising new technologies for effecting a distinction between good and evil, is the key to the interest of the story. In what follows, I'm going to argue that Jekyll and Hyde serves as a powerful metaphor for both specifically late Victorian perplexities about criminality and responsibility, and for more persistently troubling questions about the legitimacy of and practical basis for criminalisation. A close reading of the story can help to illustrate the complex mix of elements bearing on criminal responsibility attribution, and incidentally, I think, to explain what's wrong with the influential argument that by the end of the 19th century, attributions of responsibility already rested primarily and unambiguously on factual findings about defendants' states of mind. Far from representing the triumph of a practice of responsibility attribution grounded in the assessment of whether a defendant's capacities were fully engaged, I'll argue that the terrain of mental derangement defences in the late 19th century helps us to understand that longer-standing patterns of moral evaluation of character remain central to the criminal process. And precisely because character remained key to the institutional effort to dissociate the elements which are bound together in consciousness, the terror of Stevenson's story resides in its questioning of whether either scientific knowledge or moral evaluation of character can provide a stable basis for attributions of criminal responsibility. In building that argument, I'll also suggest that Stevenson's tale can help us to make sense of the resurgence of overtly character-based practices of attribution in Britain today. I'll proceed as follows. I'll first juxtapose a contemporary case at the Old Bailey with the case of Jekyll and Hyde, drawing out and analysing the narratives of responsibility attribution which we can find in both texts. I'll then locate this analysis within a broader set of hypotheses about the historical trajectory of ideas of responsibility. And in conclusion, I'll draw out some implications for contemporary criminal law. On the 4th of February, 1889, 3 years after Robert Louis Stevenson let the respectable Dr. Henry Jekyll and his terrifying alter ego, Edward Hyde, loose on the streets of London, 37-year-old Julia Georgina Spickenell was indicted at the Old Bailey for the willful murder of her 9-month-old daughter. The facts of the case were devastatingly simple. Spickenell had called on her downstairs neighbour, Mary Ann Goldring, telling her that I have something to show you. The something, tragically, was the youngest of Spickenell's 4 children, whom she had drowned in a pail of water. Goldring in turn called out another neighbour, and both women testified at the trial to Spickenell's distracted request for a razor or a rope with which to take her own life. Apart from the testimony of these two neighbours, her trial, predictably enough, was dominated by medical evidence. Equally predictably, each of the doctors tailored their evidence carefully to the doctrinal requirements of the McNaghten rules. 2 of the witnesses specifically testified that she was incapable of appreciating the nature and quality of the act, while a third, echoing late Victorian views on female biology and mental stability, suggested that what was at issue was mania arising from over-lactation. The jury agreed, and Julia Spickenell was duly found guilty of the act, but, being insane at the time, was detained until Her Majesty's pleasure be known. Now, if these facts mark the limit of the report, there'd be little remarkable about it. It will be exactly what we would expect to find in an insanity case of its time. Doctors dominate the trial. Spickenell's claim that she suffered pains in the back of the head reflects the prevailing idea of mental illness as located physically in the brain. And the McNaghten rules structure both testimony and decision. But actually, though the report is quite terse, Both medical and lay testimony are punctuated by another rather different theme. As Spigonal put it to her neighbour, "The devil made me do it. He's been following me about up and downstairs these last 5 weeks." And in the words of Philip Gilbert, the medical officer of Holloway Prison, she sobbed and said she'd been an extremely wicked woman, that she'd gone through hell, that she'd been a wicked wretch all her life and was unfit to live. Besides this, she was under the delusion that she heard a voice that came from the devil continually accusing her of doing nothing but take care of herself. That whatever she was doing, she heard this voice accusing her of self-indulgence. Speaking volumes about the prevailing norms against self-indulgence, particularly for women, this passage also conjures up a much older discourse of wickedness and its relation to crime. And significantly, it inserts this wickedness into a narrative in which the defendant's own responsibility is unsettled by the assertion of another agency, in this case, that of the devil. Of course, the doctor deftly subsumes the devil within medical discourse, but his references to wickedness float outside the medical frame and testify to the enduring association of crime with bad character. Just as Julia Spigonal's case could be read as a classic instance of medicalised insanity, so Robert Louis Stevenson's strange case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde is generally thought of as a product of Stevenson's undoubted interest in contemporary medical science and evolutionary theory. Presented as a case from the points of view of two doctors and a lawyer, the essential lines of the story are well known. A socially distinguished and intellectually talented doctor, Henry Jekyll, a man in the very pink of the proprieties, is driven by curiosity in chemical research and by a desire to disguise his taste for low pleasures through the adoption of an alternative identity. With these motivations, he devises a potion which allows him to escape his generally self-denying toils by turning himself temporarily into the reckless Edward Hyde. But Hyde's pleasures do not stop with the sexual excesses at which Stevenson hints, but gradually expand to embrace violence and ultimately murder. As time goes on, Hyde's personality and body become dominant, and the transformative drug begins to lose its efficacy. When Jekyll is finally effaced, leaving only his documentary statement of the case, Hyde is forced to commit suicide in order to escape the gallows. Hyde's small physical stature and repellent features, along with what we would today call a psychopathic lack of affect, evoke an atavistic figure, in Stevenson's words, an ape-like survival within the highly evolved Jekyll and within civilised Victorian society. Jekyll tries to displace his own responsibility by creating Hyde. It was Hyde, after all, and Hyde alone that was guilty. But since Jekyll, at least initially, exercises the power of voluntary change to become Hyde, he perhaps bears responsibility for the upshot of that decision. Indeed, the disturbing implication is that, notwithstanding this split identity, Jekyll, in some senses, is Hyde. As Jekyll himself puts it, this too was myself. Now, I suppose you could think that that brings with it a comforting idea that ultimately individual responsibility can't be evaded. But at a social level, the implications of the story are unavoidably disturbing. Hyde resides within Jekyll. He's the evil side of my nature. So the story challenges the very project of distinguishing and regulating criminality. Moreover, Stevenson implies that civilised society, like Dr. Jekyll, in effect creates and hence bears responsibility for for its criminal underside. Now, themes from the criminology, from evolutionary theory, and from medical psychology of the time are very prominent in Stevenson's story. And its resonance with these prevailing preoccupations doubtless accounts to some extent for its instant success. But like Spickernall's case, the case of Jekyll and Hyde is not marked only by this modern psychological, biological theme. Originally written for the Christmas crawler market of spine-chilling stories, Strange Case is an unmistakable member of the Gothic tradition in English literature. This is significant in terms of the images of criminality which we'd expect to find in the book. From the mid-18th century on, as the novel gradually claimed a place in polite society and high culture, the description of criminality which had formed a place in the work of early writers like Defoe was gradually evacuated from the realist tradition and displaced onto the Gothic tradition of Walpole, Radcliffe and others. To paint with very broad brushstrokes, this strand of literature diversified in the 19th century into a variety of forms such as the Newgate novel, the novel of sensation and horror stories. Like Mary Shelley's Frankenstein at the start of the 19th century, Stevenson's Jekyll and Hyde at its end is therefore concerned not only with the modern theme of interior subjectivity and psychology, or with medically or socially determinist accounts of criminality, like those which dominate Dickens's later work, but also with an older theme of hellish evil, of, as Stevenson puts it, the slime of the pit appearing on earth. In Stevenson's tale, this preoccupation with lurking evil and with how to ascribe responsibility for it is underlined by a welter of biblical references, doubtless reflecting Stevenson's Presbyterian background from which he'd rebelled. Both Jekyll's and Frankenstein's experiments evoke the story of original sin, with its vision of the human search for knowledge as a flouting of traditional authority and a flirting with evil or the devil. And while the story invites us to evaluate Hyde's conduct and character as unambiguously evil, it complicates our judgment by implying that he and Jekyll are the same person. Hugely innovative, Stevenson's Jekyll and Hyde took the long-standing preoccupation of Gothic literature with terror and the supernatural. It removed them from history and distance and placed them firmly in the here and now of 19th century London and the world of science. In doing so, he produced a tale which is not only a powerful allegory of late Victorian society, but also a suggestive metaphor for some persisting themes in criminal justice. Now, in using Stevenson's tale as a metaphor in interpreting some criminal justice themes, I'm drawing on a hypothesis which I've developed and defended at greater length in a recent book, which Victor was kind enough to mention, and in a few articles. The key assumption of this work is that patterns of responsibility attribution relate to the roles and needs of a criminal justice system, to a political need for legitimation, and to a practical need to specify and coordinate the sorts of knowledge which can be brought into a courtroom. The imperatives set by these needs for legitimation and coordination are changing over time as the political, cultural, and economic environment of the criminal process shifts. Let me very briefly set out my account of how practices of responsibility attribution changed over the two centuries running up to Jekyll and Hyde. In the 18th century, I want to argue that the operative assumption underlying an attribution of criminal responsibility was that the defendant's conduct exhibited or expressed bad character. This was a holistic judgment of wrongful conduct and dangerousness, rather than today's supposedly analytical separation of external conduct from internal mens rea. The trial afforded the defendant the opportunity of exculpating him or herself. And indeed, it was out of these developing arguments about exculpatory defences that the elaborated doctrine of responsibility as something which had to be proven by the state for inculpation eventually emerged in the latter half of the 19th century. Meanwhile, the key variable in most criminal trials was the defendant's capacity to gather together credible people willing to speak for and back up her testimony. Even when the defendant's mental state was unavoidably at issue, attributions of responsibility were based on judgments about the quality of character displayed in conduct, rather than on an investigation of whether the defendant's cognitive or volitional capacities were fully engaged in that relevant action. This pattern of character-based responsibility, which I maintain dominated the 18th century criminal trial, and indeed persisted in some areas long into the 19th century, shares some obvious features with George Fletcher's famous notion of manifest criminality. This is a pattern which rests on the assumption that crime is readily recognisable by members of the community, and which is therefore underpinned by a belief in a widely shared ability to make confident evaluations on the basis of appearances. In Fletcher's account, this pattern of manifest criminality is gradually displaced in the 19th century by a subjective pattern which locates criminality in the intention of the defendant, alongside a harm or risk-based pattern which focuses on outcomes. The institutional mechanisms needed to render subjective responsibility an object of proof were not yet in place in the 18th century, nor was the lack of them yet felt to be a pressing practical or ethical problem. But this world was beginning to change, and the long 18th century saw the gradual assembly of many of the doctrines and institutional arrangements which we take for granted in criminal law today. Now, in the context of my sort of hypothesized trajectory from primarily character-based to more capacity-based responsibility, the late 19th century presents itself as a rather interesting focus. By this time, most of the institutional changes which distinguish the modern criminal justice system, legal representation by defense lawyers, systematic law reporting, an organised legal profession, a developed law of evidence, and so on, were in place. And the growth of what we now call the medical sciences had rendered plausible and presumptively practicable a trial process which set up the state of a defendant's mind as an object of proof. Moreover, these legal and procedural changes arguably mapped onto a deeper set of changes in ideas about human identity. While social institutions in the still stratified and relatively stable world of the 18th century exhibited a confidence about reading character, credit, or even conduct from status and surface, the more mobile, urbanised world of the 19th century was generating a new set of coordination problems by undermining the practical basis for those assessments. At the same time, it was experiencing a new and acute legitimation need as emerging democratisation posed a demand for more individualised assessments of credibility. While the emergence of the Romantic movement had consolidated a developing trend to see the essence of human identity as residing not in the external markers of conduct, but rather in the inner recesses of the mind or the soul. This was also a rapidly changing world, and one in which conflict about even core values informing criminal law was on the increase. In this context, and that of the rapidly expanding regulatory tasks to which criminal law was being put, as Lindsay Farmer has argued, the traditional notion of crime as reflecting a widely shared notion of public wrong became elusive. As confidence in consensus and in the recognisability of criminal conduct declined, the weight of criminal law's legitimation was projected increasingly onto the proof of individual responsibility, conducing to a decline of evaluative notions of responsibility and a rise, so the argument goes, of factualised notions. But had character disappeared, or had it merely been realigned in relation to the newer discourses of responsibility? Even in London, evidence about character and reputation remained important to social control. Even in the Old Bailey insanity cases for the 1880s, which I reviewed for this lecture, character evidence looms large. While Caroline Conley's study of late Victorian Kent shows that local knowledge and informal mechanisms of judgment of character remained central to the operation of criminal justice. This persisting importance of character and reputation to social control actually surfaces in Stevenson's story. The witness to one of Hyde's misdemeanours effectively coerced him by threatening him that if he fails to make compensation to his victim, if he had any friends of any credit, we undertook that he should lose them. But could this economy of character any longer be relied on as a social mechanism for distinguishing criminality? And were either the surface signals of character or the psychological depths of engaged human capacity legible by the Victorian courts? So, within my developmental hypothesis, we might assume that this decisive process of institutional modernisation and law reform, which happened mainly in the first two-thirds of the 19th century, plus the gradual rise of medical science and of medical testimony in insanity cases, would have meant that capacity-based, internal or subjective criminality would have been firmly established as the prevailing pattern by the time that Jekyll and Hyde was written. Now, my ambition in my overall project is actually to bring this story up to the present day. And that got me thinking more recently about how to interpret the undoubted, if unappealing, fact that explicitly character-based patterns of attribution appear to be experiencing something of a comeback as we move into the 21st century. Emerging from their subterranean, though obviously important, position at the prosecution and sentencing stage, character-based principles are enjoying a revival, not just in obvious phenomena like three strikes and you're out, sentencing laws, or paedophile registers, but also in the substantive criminal law, particularly in that dealing with terrorism, and in the operation of evidential presumptions, detention rules, and perhaps most obviously, the renewed, after nearly 200 years, admissibility of evidence of bad character. Why, I asked myself, had character suddenly become an acceptable explicit principle of criminalisation once again? And did this imply that its decline had been more formal than real? Now, in trying to think about that question, it seemed to me that the treatment of what we today call mental incapacity defences, in which what then became the psychiatric profession was emerging as an authoritative witness to the facts of the matter in the late 19th century, would be particularly instructive. In principle, these late 19th century insanity cases should reflect the most fully developed aspect of the internal psychological model of criminal responsibility or irresponsibility. To the extent that it doesn't do so, that raises interesting questions about whether the evaluative character-based practice had really gone away. Now, we turn the clock back again for a brief moment to think about how insanity was dealt with in the 18th century criminal courts. We find something that's really very striking to the modern legal gaze. There were already at this stage rules on competency for witnesses, but there was no statutory recognition of an insanity defence until 1800, and no really elaborated common law definition of insanity until it was concretised in the McNaghten Rules in 1843. Of course, lots of potential insanity cases were filtered out of the criminal process long before they came to trial. But significant numbers of putatively insane defendants nonetheless did reach the courts. Joel Eigen has identified 331 cases before the Old Bailey between 1760 and 1843. When these cases did reach the courts, their disposal was shaped by common sense jury assumptions about madness and its implications for the vicious will which underpinned culpability. It shouldn't really come as any surprise that there's very little sign in the Old Bailey cases of any analysis of the definitions of insanity discussed by treatise writers like Hale or Blackstone. Usually, there wasn't a defence lawyer. And even though medical testimony was gradually emerging as relevant, it was in its early forms itself very closely articulated with various forms of lay knowledge, as indeed was to be expected in an era in which the formal organisation of the medical profession was very far from having gained a monopoly over what we might call medical practice. As Arlie Lofnan has argued, the prevailing pattern here might be called a pattern of manifest madness. Insanity was simply what a jury recognised as such. And the system worked on the basis of a deep implicit confidence in the institutional capacity of the trial to read criminal irresponsibility. In this rather fluid context, as Dana Rabin has shown, prevailing cultural influences had a decisive and direct effect. The emerging culture of sensibility in the latter part of the 18th century prompted defendants to push the boundaries of what had conventionally been understood as insanity, to embrace a wide variety of states of emotional distress, gradually introducing into the courtroom a mind-body distinction which was new and which reflected both the emerging idea of human identity as residing in a mental interior and some confidence in the capacity of the trial to investigate that interior. This process, however, was ultimately seen as threatening to the integrity of the law's prohibitions. It was accordingly closed off through the increasingly technical specification of the conditions of the insanity defence from the 19th century on. From the beginning of the 19th century, we see this interest in subjective experience pressing its way onto the trial's agenda. But ironically, the increasing cultural acceptance of the power of this sort of subjective experience, which legitimated a more expansive terrain for defences, simultaneously posed a big coordination problem for criminal law. A problem really about the trial's capacity adequately to assess the relevant evidence. The law's response was a predictable one. It tried to close down the problem by focusing mental incapacity defences exclusively onto cognitive as opposed to volitional incapacities. So the McNaghten rules focused on the cognitive defect with its test of a failure to know the nature and quality of the act. So in widening the already opened doorway to the medical witness, this new definition of insanity further undermined the process of lay evaluation, which had underpinned the practice of mental incapacity for the past centuries. Or did it? In fact, I want to argue that the matter was very much more complicated. We can begin to see why when we remind ourselves of the fact that the cognitive failure which has to be proven under the McNaughton rules can take one of two forms. It can be either an inability to know the nature and quality of the act, or it can be an incapacity to know right from wrong. Now, the idea of knowing right from wrong is, of course, an inextricable mix of fact and evaluation. Its presence in the rules means that it's hardly surprising that the latter 19th century was marked by a persistent debate about the concept of so-called moral insanity. The key point at which pressure for the expansion of the defence to cover, in effect, cases of volitional defect was applied. Undaunted by the McNaughton rules, medical witnesses made repeated attempts to establish a defence of irresistible impulse, and where unable to frame a defence of insanity cast as a lesion of the will, took their campaign into the emerging territory of mens rea, arguing that a damaged will undermined criminal responsibility. If, to quote one medical witness, a person in a state of acute mania would not think about the moral quality of her acts, and if the inability to know right from wrong itself flowed from a deranged judgment, the gap between someone who just couldn't help themselves and someone who failed to understand what they're doing is perilously fine, as indeed Julia Spickamore's case illustrates. So it's important not to exaggerate the apparent shift from an evaluative to a scientific worldview. For the late Victorian discourses of criminal pathology were, like the discourses of mind doctors of the era, themselves imbued with evaluations of moral character. Throughout the second half of the 19th century, the concept of moral insanity was drawn on to conflate capacity, conduct, and character, focusing on external signs of danger or degeneracy rather than internal features of psychology and intentionality. And this continuing focus on character is reflected in a number of tangible institutional arrangements which Lucia Zedner has tracked across the century. For example, the impressionistic category of the criminal classes, those of bad reputation, was regarded as hugely important to the identifiability of those thought to be vicious in character. Making a little cut here, partly induced by panic at the sight of that clock which says 7:45. So really, the context, what I'm wanting to argue in this section is that the context of this persistent debate about moral insanity in which medicine and morals are absolutely inextricable helps us to make sense of the fact that in Jekyll and Hyde, Stevenson represents Dr. Jekyll's failure of self-control in keeping Hyde at bay as fundamentally a moral failure and not a psychiatric pathology. And we can see Jekyll's emerging inability to control his translation into Hyde as a cornerstone of the story's horror. Now, so far, I've argued that the 19th century conception of criminal responsibility and, by implication, of non-responsibility represents, therefore, a sort of complex mix of evaluation and factual assessment. Certainly, at the level of legitimation, social conditions as various as the diversification of criminal law, democratisation, and the growth of the sciences of mind and brain gave a new spin to conceptions of criminal responsibility as founded in inner mental states. Similarly, at the level of coordination, the modernisation of criminal procedure, the growth of legal representation and hence of legal doctrines, and the rise of expert witnesses created new resources for the investigation of the factual aspects of criminal responsibility. Evaluations of character hadn't disappeared, but their balance with the newer psychological discourses was changing. Yet there was anxiety about the robustness of this new psychological model. And as Eigen has noted, this found expression in a curious new phenomenon which found its way with increasing frequency into the criminal courts. This was a genre of defendants who, though not obviously displaying the classic marks of insanity, such as mania or radical cognitive dysfunction, claimed exculpation on the basis that they were, like Dr. Jekyll, mentally absent from the scene of the crime. Unconscious crimes didn't fall squarely within the McNaughton Rule's definition of insanity. These rather were failures of volition or cases of suspended consciousness unrelated to disease. Now, Eigen traces the genesis and disposal of these cases in the criminal courts and says that they represent a pervasive Victorian preoccupation which realised itself in a public obsession with mesmerism, hypnosis and sleepwalking. Phenomena, by the way, which find expression in 19th century novels as diverse as George Eliot's Daniel Deronda, Wilkie Collins' The Moonstone, and Thomas Hardy's Tess of the D'Urbervilles. This sort of popular interest, epitomised by the Victorian obsession with public displays of hypnotism, discloses a fundamental tension. As Eigen nicely puts it, given Victorians' well-documented preoccupation with the will and the era's paramount goal of fostering an ethic of self-mastery among all British citizens, such morbid fascination with unconscious and uncontrollable behaviour reminds one of someone with an abject fear of snakes who, upon entering a zoo, makes his way immediately for the reptile house. In unravelling the causes of this preoccupation, Eigen's starting point is the way in which this claim of absent or double or suspended consciousness went right to the core of the Victorian conception of responsibility as founded in consciousness. He examines a sample of cases in the Old Bailey which challenge that model by developing a new vocabulary embracing somnambulism and absence, amnesia and passion. I'm quoting, drawing the courtroom defendant further away from the centuries-old conception of the person as a consequences perceiving, conscious and remembering being. The McNaughton rules proved to be ineffective in closing the door to these sorts of defences. Where they went beyond the McNaughton rules, juries quite often brought in verdicts, which didn't technically exist as verdicts. But of course, the jury was much more articulate in those days. So, for example, they would find not guilty on grounds of unconsciousness. Now, of course, these defendants didn't have either our 20th century psychiatric vocabulary of multiple personality disorder, nor the Freudian framework of the unconscious available. But it didn't prevent them from using available cultural resources, notably the language of memory and unconsciousness, that horror of learning of what one has done, and by implication of not having been aware of it or present at the time, to distance their responsibility. Here, as Eigen puts it, was ample evidence that actual courtroom persons were anything but a unity, as criminal law assumed. Eigen suggests that in the light of psychoanalytic theory, today's reader of the Old Bailey Sessions papers would begin to wonder whether the supposed discontinuity really reveals different persons or irreconcilable emotions within the same person. And of course, it's precisely that sort of anxiety and that sort of phenomenon to which Stevenson's case of Jekyll and Hyde speaks. In the first place, like defendants relying on states of absence of mind, double consciousness, or possession by the devil, Jekyll tries to not merely to displace his desires, but also his responsibility onto Hyde, whom he himself then diagnoses as suffering from moral insanity. Yet the story is resonant with swinging moral evaluations of Hyde as wicked, evil, and so on. Yet Hyde resides within Jekyll. He represents the ultimate crisis of judgment. The unitary subject is split asunder, negating a straightforward attribution of factual responsibility. That split also undermines the older discourse of evaluation of character by representing character too as split. And the hope that new scientific knowledges of both medical science and evolutionary biology will provide new technologies for identifying criminality to replace the older model of character, as shown in Stevenson's horror story, to be an illusion. In a complex world, Hyde sort of represents a nostalgia for an earlier world of confident moral evaluation, where Satan's signature upon a face is manifest, but also a deep perplexity about the implications for individual responsibility of an emerging sense of the multiplicity of human subjectivity. Now, this sense of the crucial importance of being able to recognise criminality, being able to recognise it institutionally, was, of course, about to realise itself in statutory form in many late Victorian provisions classifying groups of offenders such as the weak-minded and the inebriate. And it was finding contemporary scientific expression in the statistical and photographic researches of Charles Darwin's cousin, the early eugenicist Francis Galton, who hoped to identify the essence of criminal personality by superimposing hundreds of photographic images of offenders in the hope of distilling a kind of common essence. Hence, perhaps, Stevenson's reversion to an older vocabulary of manifest evil. Yet the reversion held little comfort in an age which aspired to ascribe individual responsibility, yet which had begun to question the location of responsibility for evil. Equally striking is Stevenson's anticipation of Freud, not merely in his model of split subjectivity with shared memory, but specifically in his observation that Jekyll's weakness of will in keeping Hyde at bay is prompted by an unconscious reservation about whether he really wants to do so. Decades before Freud's real reception, defendants in the criminal courts were posing the question of responsibility for conduct beyond consciousness. It's perhaps a puzzle that neither legal doctrine nor criminal law theory have been keen to explore the resolution to this problem offered by Freudian theory, which, in relating the subject structurally to its unconscious, provides a framework within which one can begin to comprehend that subject's responsibility for conduct generated by its unconscious. Whatever the explanation, Jekyll and Hyde stands for a world in transition and to some extent in crisis. Juxtaposing evolutionary biology, psychological medicine and biblical judgment, informed by modern science, yet deeply preoccupied by moral conventions, it leaves the reader perplexed as to the proper way in which to attribute responsibility for Jekyll's imperfectly realised inhibition and Hyde's manifestly criminal act. So to conclude, Jekyll and Hyde stands in part for the continuing appeal of a strongly evaluative and partially character-driven practice of responsibility attribution, even at the supposed climax of the era of psychologisation of criminal responsibility. It expresses a strong anxiety about the recognisability of responsibility for crime and even about the very grounds for criminal judgment. But what light can this late 19th century tale and its analogues in the criminal courts shed on the resurgence of overtly character-based principles of attribution in the early 21st English criminal process? Today's lecture really amounts to the first stage in what I hope will be a multi-level construction of the relevant arguments. Basic thought is a simple one. If we can find traces of a character-based pattern of attribution, even in apparently the most unlikely of places, the operation of mental incapacity offences, apparently trained on the psychology of individuals in the late 19th century and beyond, this lends credence to the argument that the overall trajectory has been one of a shift in the alignment of two always coexisting principles of attribution, rather than a gradual displacement of one by another. And that consequently, any adequate explanatory theory of criminal responsibility will always have to embrace both psychological and evaluative dimensions, while attending carefully to the shifting relationship between them and to the institutional and cultural conditions which underpin those shifts. But what does shape and underpin that balance? Jekyll and Hyde can, I think, at least help us to make a start in unravelling this mystery. Here's my speculative suggestion. A world which purports to give priority to capacity-based practices of responsibility attribution, one which claims to take individuals and their engaged capacities rather than their social status or appearance seriously, will be a world in which there is a strong felt sense of the legitimation requirements posed by individual freedom, and one which enjoyed some confidence in its institutional ability to deliver such individualised judgments while maintaining adequate levels of social control. Now, such a world arguably has never existed. But that individualising impulse most certainly did have an impact on the form of part of criminal law over the course of its modernisation. But we might speculate that at times when the sentiments favouring individual freedom and equal liberties are fragile, perhaps because of fears about crime or terrorism or order more generally, explicitly character-based patterns of attribution tend to enjoy a revival. And as a number of social theorists have argued, thanks or perhaps no thanks to a welter of political, social and most recently economic conditions, this is precisely the situation we find ourselves in Britain today. The late 19th century context in which Stevenson was writing bears some striking analogies with that context. Democracy had extended in 1884 to male householders and covered about 60% of the adult male population. Yet social stratification remained the order of the day, and the degenerate classes, that's the contemporary term, were inevitably seen by the respectable as posing a threat to social order. But it wasn't only the degenerate classes which posed a threat to traditional ideas of authority. There was also an economic recession which spanned the 1870s and 1880s, early intimations of the collapse of empire, incipient troubles in Ireland in the form of the Fenians' activities and the struggle for home rule. These went alongside a perceived loosening of traditional structures of inheritance and family in an era of increasing individual choice, and the challenges to religion and tradition represented by increasingly professionalised scientific experimentation. Science and medicine were ambivalent developments. On the one hand, they seemed to promise a new technology of proof and legitimation. On the other, the currency of evolutionary theory and early medical science was perceived as threatening individual responsibility, prompting one reviewer to complain that Stevenson's story added to this culture by reducing individual freedom to zero, weakening the sense of responsibility. Clues to these prevailing social anxieties are to be found in Jekyll's more traditional medical colleagues' deep suspicion of the course of his chemical researches, and his lawyer's horror at the testamentary provisions which leave all his property to the unknown Hyde. Choice and science at once threatened the established order and promised resources for recreating, in the case of science, a new era of manifest criminality through the methods designed to establish criminal character. In the end, the capacity principle gained a serious ideological foothold, displacing explicit character attribution onto the less visible areas of the prosecution and sentencing processes. Meanwhile, technologies geared to the identification of criminals, from professional detective work and policing through Lombrosian criminology and statistics to today's offender profiling, these technologies multiplied in a succession of developments which have walked in a curiously separate track from the discursive commitment to individual responsibility in criminal law. The revival of character in contemporary criminal justice might be seen as the criminal law manifestation, in short, of what David Garland has called the culture of control. A reverberation of anxiety in a world marked by renewed economic and social insecurity, and one in which several countries have manifested an impulse to ever greater criminalisation and penal harshness. In standing for the duality of not only human identity, but also of criminal judgment, Jekyll and Hyde reminds us that the development of responsibility attribution is not a linear trajectory from status to contract, from manifest to subjective criminality, from character to choice and capacity, but rather a complex and shifting alignment of apparently competing principles which coalesce, more or less successfully, to legitimate and coordinate criminal judgment under specific social conditions. Thank you.
So thanks very much to Professor Lacey for a wonderfully stimulating lecture full of insights across the centuries. We now have a brief time for questions, and if you could keep them reasonably short, please, we don't have that long. I'll try and gather more than one question, and then Professor Lacey will be happy to answer them.
It's obviously, with a very broad hypothesis like this, it's very hard to trace exact causal vectors. But I think the causation is definitely moving back and forth. So I think that it's not all in one direction. I think that it's true that, I'm a firm believer that you need certain kinds of institutional developments to think in a certain way about responsibility. But on the other hand, as ideas outside the legal system also have an impact on the way in which people's responsibility and capacity for choice and so on is thought about, that poses new questions which themselves knew what I've called legitimation questions, which then tend to prompt institutional innovation. So I'm sort of thinking about, in a way, two different movements in different directions. It's a good question. Yeah.
But also a manipulative device in the other. And isn't one of the explanations for what you're describing is that as the jury ebbs and flows in its popularity and indeed its efficiency, partly due to the way in which the direction of the judge and the context of how juries are chosen, indeed, you know, the representation nature of it, isn't that one of the reasons why what you're picking up is in fact a flux, a change, a pragmatism in the system?
I think that's absolutely right. And, of course, it's a sort of frustration in this country that jury research is so circumscribed. But I think that's absolutely right, that the role of the jury, how the jury is perceived, the social composition of the jury, the reputation of the jury as an institution is a very key part of the story. Yep.
And the work by Douglas Hay.
Absolutely. Yep.
Actually tried to show the cause and effect. Yep.
Yes. Yes.
The sort of strategic logic of the lawyer's analytical brain.
Yeah.
Because of the way in which the jury was there as a metaphor.
Yes. Yes. Now, I completely agree with you about that. And I think the work of people like Hay and indeed Peter King is tremendously useful in this. Yep. Yep.
Whether in an imperial context, one of the things that might be encouraging legal profession to move away from character was the greater difficulty of leading character in imperial context.
Mm.
So that that might put some burden or given some impetus to the legal profession, many of whose judges will have had colonial experience.
Yep, absolutely.
To consider things that weren't as
I think that's a great suggestion, and actually really borne out by the fact that although the 19th century was this era of sort of constant debates about codification, the only place we ever did it was India. And I'm sure for precisely that reason, you want to formalise and de-evaluate, as it were, as your terrain is less... Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Why don't we draw it to a close in that case? And there's a reception outside with some wine. It just remains to thank Professor Lacey very much for an excellent lecture. Terrific. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.